This is Washington Watch with Tony Perkins, your daily voice in Washington, D.C. on the issues of faith, family, and freedom. And now, here's your host, Family Research Council President Tony Perkins.
Sitting in today for Tony Perkins are FRC's own Peter Sprigg, Senior Fellow of Policy Studies, and Chris Gasek, Senior Fellow for Regulatory Affairs. They are two of the foremost Christian experts on social policy in the United States. Welcome to the show, Peter and Chris.
Thank you, and welcome to Washington Watch with Tony Perkins. Tony's not here today, as you heard. My name is Peter Sprigg.
Good to see you again, Peter, and good to be back. You know, we haven't been here in a while.
That's right. It's been a while since we...
It must have been something we said.
Well, we have a lot of other
very gifted and talented
substitute hosts that Tony's been able to call on. So we're grateful for them as well, but grateful for the opportunity to be back with you today. And we have, I think, an interesting show for you. We were laughing here a little bit because those of you who are just listening to the news feed there at the top of the hour from AFA, we're going to get to hear at a little greater length from some of the same people that they interviewed.
Right, exactly.
I think great minds think alike in terms of some of the top news issues of the day, news stories of the day, and who the experts are that we go to for insight into them. So let me first give you the phone number. We may have an opportunity to take some of your calls. We're looking at possibly a fourth guest during our final segment today. But if we have a chance to take your guests, it will be beginning at 42 minutes after the hour. So let me give you the number right now. It's 1-866-372-7234. I'll give that to you one more time in case you are looking for something to write with. If you want to join the conversation in our last segment of our show at 42 minutes after the hour, the number is 1-866-372-7234. Well, the big news story today, one of those relatively rare days in the United States when the top news story is clearly one from overseas, and in this case from the United Kingdom, where the electorate, where the public has voted to withdraw their nation from the European Union. A lot of hand-wringing about this, very close vote. People were not sure how it was going to go, but in the end, the Brexit vote, as it's been
British exit.
Nicknamed, the British exit from the European Union, was successful, the people who wanted to leave. And so we want to talk about what all this means with James Roberts. He's a research fellow for economic freedom and growth at the Heritage Foundation right here in Washington. And with extensive international experience and as a foreign service officer, as well as a great deal of economic knowledge. James Roberts, are you with us?
I am. Thank you.
Okay. Well, thanks for joining us.
Pleasure to meet you.
Nice to meet you.
So maybe for our listeners who aren't as familiar with the background, maybe you could take a couple minutes to give first, a couple of, just a basic picture of what the European Union is, what its purpose is, and then the background on how this referendum came about.
Okay, and thanks for the opportunity. The European Union really got its start in the aftermath of the devastation of World War II. And certainly, the United States and other countries wanted to avoid a repeat of the miserable loss of life and destruction of the 20th century. In Europe, Germany started two wars. And so the European Union really started as what they called the common market. First, what they called the coal and steel agreement in the early 50s, and then it turned into a common market. And in 1975, the UK entered that common market with certainly the goal of increasing its market for its goods and services. And so It went along okay, but the vision of people in Brussels and a lot of people in Europe, especially Germany and France, was to make it a United States of Europe, to have a common law, common legislature, and common currency. And that's what they were doing when they extended the euro, created the euro currency about 15 years ago. And so it gradually came to be seen and resented by a lot of people in Europe, especially in the UK, as having people in Brussels, unelected bureaucrats, civil servants, dictating that really the details of everyday life, imposing a lot of costly regulations on business, pursuing an agenda that really looked pretty far, often far left or at least center left, cultural values of the left. And so there was growing resentment to this imposition of these values from the continent. You know, the United Kingdom, England, they have had a long tradition of individuality, of independence, going back hundreds of years vis-a-vis the continent of Europe. So this is not a surprise. This represents the culmination of really decades of discussion and some anger and some frustration, and not just among conservatives in the UK, but also really what put it over the top yesterday with this vote was blue-collar Labour Party voters in the northeast of England and Midlands that don't feel like the elites in London were listening to them, and they really sent a powerful message.
Now, my understanding from one of the reports I read is that Prime Minister David Cameron, who announced his resignation today in the wake of this vote.
I mean, not immediate resignation.
Not immediately, but that he will step down. He had called this vote sort of in response to pressure, but he was not a supporter of the exit vote. What were some of the political dynamics within Prime Minister Cameron's party that led to this vote?
Oh, that's right. And as we see, you know, with the various coalitions that are part of the two major parties in our country, that's what political parties are, and they represent smaller, relatively smaller, but important and significant coalitions and groups of people pursuing sometimes somewhat different or very different agendas. So Cameron and, you know, the financial services industry in around London, which has been very successful in part because it was in the EU, they really didn't want to have this vote, but for Cameron to get reelected, and he was reelected last year, even in a surprise that the polls didn't show that he would be, he knew he had to really make this kind of vote happen so that he could bind his coalition of the Conservative Party and not have it break away, have this small party called UKIP, United Kingdom for Independence Party, that's a pretty far-right party that was taking a lot of votes from the mainstream Conservative Party. So he did this, made this promise to have this vote, and clearly he hoped and expected that his side of the Conservative Party would vote to stay in the European Union. And the same thing happened with political calculus with the Labour Party, that many of the Labour Party elites wanted to stay in, but a lot of the rank and file, you know, blue-collar members, angry about this being displaced in this fast-changing economy, had other ideas.
Now, one of the things, it seems that one of the issues that has really maybe changed the whole climate in 2016 on this issue is what's happening with respect to immigration. Are you in a position to comment on what role you think immigration played?
I do think it played a significant role, and I think that is where the pro-European Union forces really had a blind spot. They couldn't, I guess, envision the negative reaction to just opening the floodgates, as it were, to immigration. There are lots of people, desperate people in Africa and the Middle East who want to get to a better life in Western Europe. And nevertheless, there's only so many people that these countries can take in.
We should perhaps explain that one of the principles of the European Union is that they have open borders between the EU countries. So once these refugees are able to enter one EU country, they can essentially go to any of them. Is that right?
That's right, and that was called the Schengen Agreement, a name for a town in Austria. So people from countries outside of that so-called Schengen area had to get a special visa, but once they got in, they could move around, although getting from the continent to the UK across the English Channel was always more of a challenge. But still, so you had a lot of immigrants coming in, taking jobs, or going on welfare, and people being a threat to the traditional ways of life and the cultural values of the people there. So that was definitely a factor, and it really falls more most on the German Chancellor Angela Merkel, who pushed Europe to accept hundreds of thousands of refugees from Syria in the last 12 or 15 months. And that, I think, really was the straw that broke the camel's back in this case, or at least it was one of the major factors, not the major factor. There are so many other issues going on.
Right. Very interesting. Now, we saw today, I think the last close of trading, the Dow Jones Industrial Average was down 600 points today or something. But this improves the dollar. The devaluation of the pound, which also has followed this, is going to make the dollar stronger relative to the pound. What are some of the implications for Americans of this vote?
Well, of course, I have to wonder whether George Soros shorted the pound yesterday and made another $1 billion the way he did in 1992. But that's just a side issue, even though, of course, he was out there on the left scaremongering people to try to vote to stay in the EU. But, these are volatile situations and disruptive, and some people panic and some people play, speculate and figure that there's going to be a psychological reaction that they're going to profit from. But I think longer term, this kind of extreme volatility will settle down. But we're in a world now where trillions of dollars flow around the world electronically every minute, and seeking yields and seeking ways to make money. So that whole sort of phenomena has been destabilizing to the whole world economy, and that's just kind of something we have to learn to live with, this greater volatility, it seems to me. But I think the upside for the UK and the U.S. is significant for out of this development. The U.S. could negotiate a really good free trade agreement with the U.K. once it leaves the European Union under a new president next year. And that could lead to more jobs, more opportunities, more trade and investment for both the U.S. and the U.K. The U.K. will not be bound by a lot of the rules that it has been laboring under. 90% of the small and medium companies in the U.K. don't trade outside the UK anyway, and have just been having to bear these costly burdens of EU-imposed regulations and pass that cost along to consumers. So there are a lot of potential benefits down the line from this development, too.
Yeah, I mean, that's one of the things that in some of the reporting I've seen, they've tried to emphasize that while the EU exists in part as a means of facilitating free trade, not being in the EU doesn't mean you can't have trade. It just means that the UK will be free to negotiate these agreements on their own, on their own terms with other countries, rather than being bound by the EU.
That's right. I mean, the UK is the second biggest economy in the EU after Germany. Certainly, those countries depend on the UK for its markets. They're not going to shut them off. That would be crazy.
Right. And we just have a few seconds left, but some of the issues that we deal with here at Family Research Council, cultural issues, things like abortion and homosexuality, the liberal bureaucrats of the EU have been trying to push that sort of agenda as well, haven't they?
They have, and the Obama administration has been accused, I think rightly so, of trying to Europeanize America in that same kind of way. So this is a big setback to them, I think. That was the problem, the reason for the pushback on the independence and sovereignty, the self-determination of British voters. They didn't like
right.
British judges being overruled by the European Court of Justice in Luxembourg.
Right. Well, thank you so much for joining us. Our time's about up, but we appreciate James Roberts with the Heritage
Great
Foundation.
Great information.
If you take a quick look at the state of America, what do you think we need most to renew our country? You may be thinking that we need better leadership within our government, more jobs, and active economic development, and you would be right. All of those things are important, and God in His power can accomplish all of them. But the most important thing we can do to align ourselves with God's will is to pray. Therefore, Family Research Council is encouraging Christians across America to participate in Call to Fall. We are asking pastors and churches to consider setting aside time during worship on Sunday, July 3rd, to call their people to get on their knees before the Lord in prayer and ask Him to renew and restore our land. If you want to learn more about this effort on July 3rd, visit calltofall.com. Join us for this inspiring time across our nation as we all seek God in our prayers and ask Him for the renewal of our country. That's call2fall.com.
God reached Michael Brown with faith in Christ when he was a 16-year-old drug-using rock and roller. With that faith, Dr. Michael Brown has devoted his life to spreading the gospel and sparking moral revolution.
The world continues to go crazy all around us. I'm here to be a voice of moral sanity and spiritual clarity.
Dr. Brown has debated Jewish rabbis, agnostic professors, and gay activists, and is widely considered to be the world's foremost messianic Jewish apologist. Dr. Michael Brown will be one of the speakers this year at the annual AFA Retreat at the Cove, October 3rd through 6th. Space is limited to 400 attendees, so make your plan soon. Get more information at afafoundation.net. Register by calling 800-950-2092, option 1, followed by option 2. It's the annual Retreat at the Cove in the beautiful Smoky Mountains of North Carolina at the Billy Graham Training Center in Asheville, North Carolina. And we hope to see you there.
This is a Decency Minute. I'm Bill Johnson. Philosophy professor Anne Maloney recently wrote for Crisis Magazine an article entitled "What the Hookup Culture Has Done to Women." In her article, she gives several examples of lives scarred by our culture's casual view of sex, and she sums them up in this way. All too often, these women come to me in a state of bewilderment. No more are they shackled by ridiculous bonds like commandments, moral rules, words like chastity. They shout, "We're free," yet they whisper, "Why are we so miserable?" It's no coincidence that the top two prescribed drugs at our state university's health center are antidepressants and the birth control pill, unquote. Sex was designed by God for marriage, to be enjoyed by a husband and a wife, and to make them one. Outside of that context, we have no peace with God or with ourselves. This is a Decency Minute. I'm Bill Johnson.
Welcome back to Washington Watch with Tony Perkins. My name is Peter Sprigg. I'm a senior fellow here at the Family Research Council with my colleague.
Chris Kasich over here was sort of a bit silent in the last interview, but that was good. You were on a roll, so we're getting a lot of good information out there.
And we wanted to talk about another story now. We're waiting for a guest to get on the line with us. But I'm sure that Tony has talked several times about the controversy over North Carolina's House Bill 2, which was, among other things, pushback against a sexual orientation and gender identity bill that had been passed by the ordinance that had been passed by the Charlotte City Council. The state legislature effectively overturned that and in particular adopted a policy regarding restrooms, showers, and locker rooms in public buildings, government-owned buildings within North Carolina, that they should be separated between males and females on the basis of your biological sex at birth. Seems logical to most people, I think, but under the pressure from the transgender movement, that's suddenly become a controversial position. And so in the wake of the passage of HB 2, there has been a lot of pressure from liberal activists and their allies in corporate America, which unfortunately are increasingly numerous. And among those corporate allies that they had recruited was apparently the National Basketball Association, the NBA, which, of course, has a team
in Charlotte,
the Charlotte Hornets, and also is scheduled to be hosting the NBA All-Star team, All-Star game in Charlotte next year, right, in 2017. And so
There's an implied threat by Adam Silver, the
NBA commissioner, that they might pull the All-Star game out of Charlotte. So some activists within North Carolina have been pushing back and chose this week for a special effort to coincide with the NBA draft was this week, shortly following the end of the season with the Cleveland Cavaliers,
right,
of course, winning their
Sunday
dramatic
night, yeah,
championship. So we've asked someone to join us, Dr. W.A. Merritt from the Southern Christian Leadership Conference. Do we have Dr. Merritt on the line yet? Still don't have him. Okay. Well, I just wanted to point out a couple things about, we have said many times that corporate America, we're not asking corporate America to endorse our position on the transgender issue, on LGBT issues. What we're asking them to do is to remain neutral. The corporate America should not be taking sides in the culture wars. These are very important, deeply felt beliefs by people on both sides. And it makes no sense at all for major corporations or for sports leagues like the NBA to be antagonizing a large part of their fan base by taking sides on an issue like this. And one of the things I want to point out as well is, you know, because I think it has not been clearly articulated enough, is that the bathroom regulation that was adopted by the legislature in North Carolina applies only to government-owned buildings. So the irony is that the NBA is free to organize their bathrooms and restrooms and showers and locker rooms any way that they want to. They can have them, you know, a transgender-friendly policy, or they can have a biological sex policy, as we would favor. But the legislature's action actually overturned an ordinance in Charlotte which would have imposed regulations on private businesses, requiring them to go by gender identity and allow biological males in the women's room. And instead leaves that decision to private business. This is something that private businesses should welcome that. And if they want to pursue pro-LGBT policies, they're free to do that.
Like the store Target is doing that all across the country.
Right.
And I think there are Targets in North Carolina. So.
Right. And of course, consumers are putting their own pressure on
right.
Target with a boycott and so forth. But that's quite separate from the from the question of what the legislature did in North Carolina. So are we still without Dr. Merritt?
Okay.
I still don't have him. Okay. Well,
so there was an effort to by a group of people opposing this sort of the potential withdrawal of the NBA All-Star game from Charlotte, because they've spent a lot of time and effort and a lot of money in Charlotte to get ready for this game. And I mean, there's a lot of preparation that goes involved. You don't just show up and start, you know, dunking the basketball a weekend before. I mean, it's like a year of preparation. And so there were a number of leaders, including the guest we were going to have who represented the Southern Christian Leadership Conference, and his name was Dr. W.A. Merritt. And they had a press conference yesterday in Charlotte in front of I believe it was at the stadium, for the Charlotte Hornets. And they were talking, you know, asking people to use the hashtag, and here it is, it's NC Loves NBA. And so you have what they call sort of a Twitter fest, I guess, right?
Right.
And so hashtag NC Loves NBA is being used to kind of make this point to the NBA and to other people that basically, you know, stay out of politics leave the basketball, you know, take care of the basketball and, you know, let democracy work in America.
And I'm sorry, Dr. Merritt apparently was not able to join us, but he represents the Southern Christian Leadership Conference. Those of you who are not as old as maybe Chris and I may not recognize the name of that organization.
What an important
organization. But that's the organization that was founded by Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. And so there were a number of prominent African-American leaders in this press conference yesterday expressing the view that the idea that opening up the bathrooms to the opposite biological sex is in no way a civil rights issue comparable to the civil rights struggle that African Americans had in the segregated South in the 1960s, which is the sort of absurd way that it's portrayed by some LGBT activists.
And some of their members feel very differently about this than this.
Exactly.
The NBA was in.
So, We'll be right back with another guest after this break.
making the most of your money. Here's Dan Celia.
Well, there's so many points that we could be talking about with the Britain exit from the European Union, but let me just touch on a couple of things. One is, as I've been saying for some time, I think this is going to be a very good thing in the long run for Great Britain, but I also think it's going to be a very good thing in the long run for the European Union. I think it is probably the beginning of the end of the European Union. This has been a failed project almost from the very beginning, and it is going to be very interesting as the other countries in the Union sit back and take a look at Switzerland, Poland, and the UK, who are going to be relatively isolated from the volatility of currencies, going to be isolated from the volatility somewhat of the markets, in a sense that they are positioned to have far greater control of the things that go on in their economy because they are not a part of the euro currency, the euro bloc. I would argue that Poland is very detached from the European Union in general, and they're the ones that are going to come out the best. We've already seen Holland people and government saying, hey, this is the way we've got to go. We've been talking about this for some time. France, the people of France have said, we ought to be considering the same thing. This is going to be, in the long run, a very good thing for Great Britain. And it certainly is going to be a good thing for Donald Trump, as he has come out and said, the people have spoken. Britain has always been a strong ally of the United States, will always be, and they will be in my administration, he says, at the top, number one, as far as trading partners go.
Welcome back to Washington Watch with Tony Perkins. Tony is out today, filling in as myself, Peter Sprigg. I'm a senior fellow here at Family Research Council with my colleague.
Chris Gasek here, back once again to sit in the, I guess this is the Sulu chair or something like that. That's a Star Trek reference for you youngins.
Now, there's an important event that's going to be taking place here in Washington tomorrow that's become an annual event. Unfortunately, this year will be, instead of trying to put pressure on the Supreme Court to do the right thing, we're going to be commemorating what happened a year ago when they did the wrong thing by imposing same-sex marriage on all 50 states in the Obergefell versus Hodges decision. But here to tell us about the march that's going to take place tomorrow is Joe Grabowski. He's communications director for the National Organization for Marriage, sponsors of the march. Joe, welcome to Washington Watch.
Thanks for having me on.
Well, tell our listeners, we just have a brief segment here. We have about 5 minutes, 5 or 6 minutes. Tell people about the march, what its purpose is, and for those in the D.C. area, when they could show up.
Sure. Well, the purpose, first of all, is simply to, you know, to mark this anniversary, which is a sad anniversary, the weekend 1 year ago when the Supreme Court decided in Obergefell that the will of five judges overruled the will of 50,000 voters in the majority of states and their legislators in imposing same-sex marriage as the new law of the land. And, you know, we believe that it was too important of a date to pass by unremarked, and there's still millions of Americans who believe that that was an erroneous decision, and we want to be their voice in Washington. That's what this march is meant to represent, to show that the American people still stand by the truth that marriage is the union of a man and a woman, and we're going to do our best to work this back. So that's the first purpose of the march. The second purpose is, of course, to call attention to the need, in the wake of Obergefell, to pass religious liberty protections and conscience protections in law to protect those people who, sadly, we have seen crop up in the news, it seems, almost every week, you know, whether it be the baker, the florist, the bed and breakfast owner, or even the public official who is forced out of their job and have their livelihoods ruined because they refuse to go along with this new same-sex marriage regime. So that would be kind of the second focus. And this year in particular, a third focus, because it's very timely, is the increasing act by the Obama administration and the governments of various states to try to impose this radical gender ideology on our communities that would say that men could simply by a whim of choice walk into a gendered facility normally reserved for women and girls, such as a locker room or a bathroom. And we think that that's a dangerous precedent, is a dangerous situation. And if nothing else, it will begin even further to teach our children that there's no difference between men and women, which will only get us further away from the ideal of the truth of marriage, which we believe takes, the complementarity of men and women coming together for the good of one another and of any children born of their union.
Yes,
the focus points of the march this year. And the march will be this Saturday in Washington, D.C. at the Capitol grounds. So that's Saturday, June 25th. And we'll be beginning to gather around 11:30 in the morning at the west side of the Capitol in front of the reflecting pool. And the march will commence after the rally program at about 1 o'clock.
And who are some of the speakers who will be addressing the crowd tomorrow? Are there
Sure. Well, we have, of course, our own president, Brian Brown. He'll be sort of emceeing the event and leading things for us there. And then we have just several prominent faith leaders and pro-family movement leaders, such as Reverend Owens from the Coalition of African American Pastors, who is a, he has a background in the civil rights movement in the 1960s and is a prominent leader of the Black Church in America. We have Jennifer Marshall of the Heritage Foundation and several other notable speakers. We really encourage people to come out and hear their message, but more importantly, to come out and, carry their signs and speak their own message to the government in this symbolic act of protest. Because, again, this is about marking that anniversary, much in the same way that the March for Life annually marks the anniversary of Roe versus Wade.
Right.
And the March for Marriage right now is certainly something on a smaller scale than the March for Life. This is the beginning of the movement that we believe has to take place in order now to take our country back from this unjust law that's been imposed on us.
Yes, I think the comparison is an apt one. I certainly for those who may believe that the opposition to same-sex marriage will simply fade away now that the Supreme Court has spoken, I hope that people will be diligent in supporting the March for Marriage annually for as long as it takes until the decision is reversed. And I think we've seen with the March for Life, as you indicated, that pro-family citizens are not easily deterred and will be faithful. The only thing I hope is that it doesn't take as long. I hope we don't have to march as long as the March for Life has in order before we can overturn this.
Yeah, that would bust our Fitbit.
unwise decision. Well, Joe, thank you for joining us on Washington Watch.
And good luck. It looks like you got good weather tomorrow, so that's good.
Yeah, we're very grateful for that, and we hope some of your listeners can join us there, and if they can't, that they will at least join us in prayer.
Thank you very much. Okay, we'll be right back in 3 minutes.
Hello, everyone. I'm Tim Wildman, president of the American Family Association and American Family Radio. One of the places we'll visit on our spiritual heritage tour of Washington, D.C. and Mount Vernon is the United States Marine Corps Memorial, also known as the Iwo Jima Memorial, built in 1954 and the largest bronze statue in the world. Stephen McDowell, who's the president of the Providence Foundation, a historian, will join us all along the way, answer questions, talk about the people, the places, and the events in our nation's capital, and then on to Mount Vernon, the home of George Washington. In addition, we'll go to Colonial Williamsburg, Jamestown, and Yorktown for those who want to join us for this separate trip, which just precedes the Washington, D.C. and Mount Vernon tour. For all the information on either of these tours, just visit us on the website, spiritualheritagetours.com. Again, this is in September. Go to the website spiritualheritagetours.com.
The AFA Cultural Institute, a video library of resources dealing with the discussions of our day.
Marriage and family, finances, how we know that the text of the Bible is actually what was originally written. The AFA Cultural Institute takes all of these topics and puts them in the hands of people to be able to equip them.
Start your library of the AFA Cultural Institute, now available for purchase as downloads or DVDs at afastore.net.
Consider serving the Lord with friendships. It's an opportunity to reach out to the needy around the world. They're now taking applications to volunteer, and they need help in the areas of mechanics, maritime, including deck, engine, and steward departments, food service, warehousing, and office. Check it out at friendships.org or call 337-433-5022.
Hi, this is Steve Tiber, president, co-founder of 8 Days of Hope. 8 Days of Hope was meant to be a one-time trip to Bay St. Louis, Waveland, Mississippi after Hurricane Katrina. And then God got involved. And since then, we have been to 9 different states, rebuilt 1,700 homes, and it's all because we love Jesus. God tells us to love Him and love others. And that's what we do, either through 8 Days of Hope or a new ministry called Hope Reigns. Hope Reigns goes immediately after disaster, a tornado, a flood, a fire, a snowstorm. But what we noticed with disasters is right after disaster, there's so many ministry opportunities. We've already been to New York, Illinois, Tennessee, Texas. So if someone's interested in 8 Days of Hope or Hope Reigns, the best place to go is our website, 8daysofhope.com. And even though we might not have an event planned the day you go to the website, if you give us your email address on our website, we'll be able to contact you about future events.
Welcome back to Washington Watch with Tony Perkins. I'm Peter Sprigg, filling in for Tony today, along with my colleague, Chris Gasek. And
Good to be here.
We have one final guest. We were able to line up a guest for
our mystery guest.
Final segment. I'm going to let Chris introduce him.
Okay. Well, our mystery guest has to do – it's a follow-up to our first interview with James Roberts of Heritage Foundation, who talked about the Brexit vote yesterday in England. And, his name is Matthew Boyle, and he is the Washington political editor for Breitbart News, which is now becoming this sort of mega site on the internet. And I just want to give a little introduce. Matthew, are you there?
I'm here. Thanks for having me, guys.
Yeah, it's great. Let me just give a little bit of introduction I've become a big Breitbart, fanboy, I guess, is the way to, I don't know if that's the way, anyway, but let me, so Breitbart, for those of you out there in the audience, they have a fantastic website with articles and things like that. But a number of you may not know that they also have a fantastic radio show on Sirius XM. And I said, so a lot of people don't get Sirius XM, but I actually have it in my car. My car came with it, and like anything in my life, once it starts, it never gets on. I'm in like a constant state of inertia. I just can't stop anything. But anyway, I love it actually. And so they're on 6 to 9 a.m. in the morning. And then on the weekends, Matthew, you're actually kind of run the weekend shows, right?
Yeah, so I host our Saturday show, which goes from 10 to 1 Eastern time on Saturday morning, 10 a.m. to 1 p.m., and then sometimes I'll do our Sunday show, too. Usually that's our editor-in-chief, Alex Marlowe.
Okay.
That goes from 7 to 10 p.m. Sunday night on the East Coast.
Because I've heard you both times. And so that show then, and then here's the important thing for those of you who don't get SiriusXM. You can get the show, and I listen to a lot of it this way, through the SoundCloud website or through the SoundCloud. There's an iPhone, a web smartphone app, and you just subscribe to Breitbart, and it'll be sort of fed to you as like an RSS feed, or just basically sent to your application, and you'll always get the segments they pick, and they edited them down, so it's a reasonable amount of time. So I just wanted to offer my congratulations to Breitbart because to the whole team over there, and in a sense, I kind of look at you and from my reading of things and sort of the hostility of the news media in Britain to the exit, you know, to sort of fair messaging. You guys are kind of like Radio Free Britain. Do you sort of feel that way? I mean,
well, look, I mean, Andrew Breitbart's mission was that he was setting out to take down the mainstream media. That includes CNN, the New York Times, the Washington Post, and over across the pond, the BBC, and the major newspapers over there as well. Most of the mainstream media, if not all of it, is literally pushing a decidedly progressive, open borders, leftist agenda. And one of the things that we've done, and the reason why we have, you know, a vast reporting team here in Washington, D.C. I'm based in D.C. I run our political team here. And then over in London, with our team that's run by Raheem Kassam, they've done a phenomenal job in terms of covering this whole Brexit vote, is the way that you beat these guys, the way you beat the mainstream media, is you go in and you start replacing them. You beat them to the news that sustains them. If you have the news, you have the narrative. So if you're able to break the news ahead of the mainstream media, and that's what we've done in terms of building political reporting teams across the country here in the United States and really around the world. We've got teams in Jerusalem, in Rome, in London, and all across the United States, from Texas to California to Washington to New York and everywhere in between. If you have the news, you have the narrative. So what we're doing is we're slowly bleeding the mainstream media dry, and we're taking their ability to influence hearts and minds across the country and around the world away from them. And we're the ones that are breaking the news.
So what do you think? What would you say that? Sure. What would you say the narrative is? How would you describe it for our audience? And the narrative for Brexit. What's the big story there?
Well, what you have in the European Union is a bunch of distant, corrupt, bureaucratic elites who have lost touch with the concerns of ordinary people in the United Kingdom, and really in every other country, too. We're actually seeing fury at the European Union in Italy, France, the Netherlands, and many other countries across Europe. It's very similar to what we see here in the United States, in that people think that Washington, D.C., and the politicians here in D.C. are not representing them well. In fact, we call our office here on Capitol Hill, we call it the embassy, because that's the name that Andrew came up with. We call it that because people, the politicians are so distant and out of touch with the ordinary voter across the country, the ordinary American that's working hard to feed their family. They're not following this stuff day in and day out. They're not fighting these battles day in and day out. And they're so, what we see is the politicians in both Washington, D.C. and in Brussels are so out of touch with the ordinary voters. And so one of the things that we've seen, that the core issues that have really led to this are these, globalist trade deals like the Trans-Pacific Partnership and the Transatlantic Partnership, and that's another one that those trade deals are things that Donald Trump talks about all the time, and Hillary Clinton supports them all. Donald Trump is opposed to them, and then also the issue, and this is the big one, is immigration. What we're seeing is the global elites are trying to have free flow of migration all around the world. They want. In the big culture clash that's happened, especially in the UK, and it's starting to happen here, we're a little bit further behind the UK on this, is this Muslim migration into the UK. You're seeing, you know, no-go zones in terms of areas that are essentially controlled by Sharia law not officially, but unofficially speaking. And you're seeing, a culture clash that comes with the lack of assimilation with mass migration. And so as that culture clash is happening, it's affecting every part of everybody's lives, from literally law and order to their job prospects to so many other parts of their lives.
Access to public services, things like that, right?
Right.
It occurs to me as I was watching the coverage today, it reminded me of something I read a number of years ago, and I wish I could remember who said it. But this would be heretical to the left, but they said you cannot have a successful multicultural society. You can have a successful multi-ethnic society, but ultimately you must have a common culture that that unites people. And I think that's is that maybe part of what's happening, is that there is just too much of a cultural divide for the society to be able to successfully navigate it. I mean, to me, the idea of Sharia law operating in some parts of Britain is an example of that. You have to have one set of laws that apply to everybody.
Right. And it's not just the laws. But you're right. It's the culture. And this is the big problem with immigration is when you overflow an area with a vast amount of migrants. I mean, look, we had a chart that came from Senator Sessions' office. He runs the Senate Immigration Subcommittee that went up about a week ago on Breitbart. And in this chart, it walks through that by the time President Obama is leaving office, he will have brought in 1 million Muslim migrants. That is 1 million people. That is an enormous amount of people who have not learned. And what happens is when they come into the United States, this is the important part of assimilation. Right. When you're talking about immigration, it is imperative for the society that people are immigrating into that they assimilate, that the immigrants assimilate, that they adopt the cultures, and that's why you hear that melting pot analogy about the great immigration waves
right.
In the early 20th century here in the United States. If they don't assimilate and they don't adopt the culture and the values of the society that they're joining, what happens is you end up with more of a salad bowl than a melting pot, and so you've got different people. Different pockets of people with different values. We kind of see this happening at least a little bit here in the United States in places like Dearborn, Michigan, where you have a vast Muslim population that is just far removed from the rest of society. They don't interact with anybody else. And so when you don't have assimilation, immigration won't work.
One of the things that strikes me is that the reason that assimilation is no longer even brought into the picture is that the left really they don't believe that the institutions of the United States or the other case of Britain are worthy of instruction to people coming in. I mean they're very anti, not just establishment. They're almost nihilistic in terms of the way that they look at the institutions of their native countries. And there's one of the things that strikes me about Breitbart is that. And the people that it was giving voice to, especially in Britain, and are people who are patriotic. I mean, Great Britain is a country that has an incredible, history of amazing things that they have done politically. Yes, and they have problems in terms of their history and with colonies and things like this. But my goodness, they developed these fantastic institutions of law and democracy and representative government, and have taken them all around the world. And the left acts like they're stormtroopers from the 30s.
Right. It's not wrong to have pride in your country.
Especially a country like that.
Yeah. And I saw another report today where they were commenting on the difference between patriotism and nationalism. That nationalism may be associated with a show of force, an assertion of power, and so forth. That may be a bigger worry. But this was a show of patriotism on the part of the British people, in a sense. That was the argument.
Yeah, look, I would say on that point too. If you look at some of these anti-Trump protesters that you see coming from the far fringe of the institutional left. Some of these groups that you see out there waving the Mexican flag, the various what are called Chicano groups, the things that they believe in, they are so far anti-American in that they want, basically all of the Western United States to be given back to Mexico. That's how far out there some of these people are, right? Like, and so what you saw here was a populist nationalist victory. On the world stage. And the other thing that's really important here is that this shows that populist nationalism can win national elections in the world. They won it in the UK. They can win it here in the United States. And it's a complete rejection of everything that Hillary Clinton and Barack Obama stand for by the voters of the UK. And the American people are getting ready to have a similar decision on Election Day in the general election in November, when they get the choice between Trump and Clinton.
You're leading into our next question, which is, what do you think the impact of this Britain's action will be on the United States?
I think that this is going to give a huge boost to Donald Trump. Donald Trump was pretty smart to go over there to Scotland and to try to ride the wave here in the wake of the Brexit vote and compare it to his campaign. Look, he's gotten more votes than any other Republican nominee in the history of the party. To more than 15 million votes, he won 37 states. And the reason why that's happening is because Donald Trump has tapped into not just constitutional conservatism. He has that going for him, but he also has tapped into this nationalist populism that exists out there, and this anger at the permanent political class here in Washington, D.C., the same anger we saw across the United Kingdom against Brussels and against Westminster, exists here in the United States. Whether it be the working class voters in Pennsylvania and Ohio and Michigan, all across the United States, all across the Western, the Midwest, throughout the Southwest. I mean, there are lots of states that may be in play down the road here because of this nationalist populism that wouldn't have been in play for a Republican down the road.
Let me ask you, yesterday when the events were unfolding, there was probably some, at least as I could discern, there were differences of opinion. Yesterday on the Breitbart broadcast before the election, it sounded to me like a couple of the people that you normally talk to were kind of downcast about events. How did you feel things were going to go? And when did as you were watching events come in, I remember I was watching and when Sunderland came in, I was like, which is a working class city in the upper northeast of England, up near Newcastle, pretty far up, close to Scotland, and it came in very decisively to leave the EU. I think that to me that was like, wow, that's kind of surprising. I'm not an expert in the politics of Great Britain, but even that shocked me. How did it go when you were listening last night?
Yeah, I it was kind of a roller coaster ride throughout the night. I mean, obviously, we found out for certain here on the East Coast around 11 o'clock or so, which is like 4 in the morning over there in the UK. So it was a really tight election. The globalist community that was leading the Remain campaign were engaged in so much misinformation all the way up, literally until the final results were in and it was clear Leave was going to win, that they refused to give Leave any of the credit that they had. I mean, they were spinning polls. They had pundits out there trying to shoot it down. And again, they were lying about everything that the Leave people were talking about, and everything that the whole referendum was about. It was a blatant misinformation campaign. By the way, these are the exact same tactics that we are going to see Hillary Clinton, the Democratic Party, and the mainstream media engage in to try to shoot down Donald Trump's candidacy. But I don't know if they're going to be successful. If anything, the Leave success suggests that Trump has a pretty good shot in November.
All right. Well, our time's about up, Matthew, but thank you so much for joining us. More insight into that British exit vote. And we thank you, our listeners. Sorry we didn't have time for your calls. Please come back and join us on Monday on Washington Watch. Have a good day.
Washington Watch with Tony Perkins is a production of the Family Research Council in Washington, D.C. For more information on anything you heard today, or if you'd like to find out how you can support the ongoing efforts of the Family Research Council, visit TonyPerkins.com. Also, to leave a comment about Washington Watch, call our new watch line at 1-866-372-7234. That's 1-866-372-7234.